This lecture is brought to you by the Orsemer Tape Library. The cassette library offers a wide range of lectures and topics. For details, contact the Orsemer Tape Library branch nearest you.
Just a few more words about the introductions, and then we'll hopefully get started on the actual list of particular issues. One thing I want to show you, we looked at a page of a Gemara yesterday, and there's one more thing I want to show you about it, right? This just happens to be Tractate Pesachim. Okay, that's not about the laws of Passover. These four lines are a Mishnah. And then the Gemara, this is the Babylonian Talmud, right? The inner column is Rashi. The outer column is largely Rashi's grandchildren. The commentary of Tosafot.
I say, there's one more bit of introductory material that I want to communicate to you, and that is, I want to give you an actual case history. Take an example, which really I could pick at random from almost any page of the Talmud, why even after you learn the Talmud, you will not be entirely clear what Jewish law is, and therefore the final bottom line you have to look at other sources. Of course, there's another problem, that sometimes the bottom line will be different depending on which source you look at. And the example that I chose is a simple example, but I think it's illustrative. And this is from Tractate Pesachim, which is the laws of Passover, page 99b, Daf Tzadik, that's folio page, 99, Amud Bet, second column, right? As I mentioned, if you look at the page of the Talmud, the first four lines are Mishnah, and then the Gemara begins, and then we have the commentaries of Rashi in the inner margin, and then Tosfos, which are Rashi's grandchildren. And the discussion is simply this. We know that the day before Passover, the Mishnah says you're not supposed to eat in the latter part of the day, the latter quarter of the day, because we don't want to ruin your appetite for the Seder. We want you to approach the Seder with hunger and anticipation, so you're not supposed to eat too much the last part of the day. Okay? That is... Okay, let me just wait a second. Are you here from Chicago? So again, the Mishnah mentions... This is an example I'm trying to illustrate why even after you learn a piece of Gemara, you still have to consult other sources for the bottom line. Mishnah says the following law. Mishnah says, Erev Pesach, that's the day before the Passover Seder, right? The Seder is Monday night, so Monday is Erev Pesach. The last quarter of the day, you're not supposed to eat because we don't want to ruin your appetite. Okay. Now the Talmud, the Gemara, asks the following question. Why does it only say the day before Passover? Well, you have a problem of the Seder. You're not supposed to do that any Friday afternoon or any day before a Yom Tov because you'll ruin your appetite. And it brings an argument between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, where Rabbi Yehuda applies this prohibition to every Shabbos or holiday. And Rav Yossi says you can eat until night. So the Gemara wants to know, neither opinion singles out Passover. Like Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, you're never allowed to eat the last quarter of the day if it's the eve of a Sabbath or a holiday. And like Rav Yossi, you're always allowed to eat. So the kasha is, the question is, the Gemara asks, why does the Mishnah single out Erev Pesach for unique treatments?
Because of appetite for the matzah.
I understand that, but according to Rabbi Yehuda, you have to have appetite for every Shabbos meal, and according to Rabbi Yossi, it's never important.
So the matzah isn't though, Mr. Yerai said I have appetite.
You're giving logic, but the question is, we have a Mishnah, and then we quote another Mishnah, which gives us an argument between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Yehuda says, every Friday afternoon, every eve of a holiday, you always have to stop eating. And Rav Yossi says you never have to stop eating. So neither opinion differentiates between Passover and Shabbos. So how come our Mishnah differentiates? In other words, who does our Mishnah follow? See, what we try to do in the Gemara is, if our Mishnah is an anonymous Mishnah, it doesn't say who said it, and we find other texts where A says one thing and B says something else, we always try to identify who is the Mishnah following. Instead of a third opinion, we want to identify who is the Mishnah following. You see what I'm saying? And the question the Gemara raises is, the Mishnah follows neither of the two recorded opinions. So the Gemara gives two answers. Gives two answers, and you'll see why this will create ambiguity as to halacha. One answer is that the Mishnah is following the view of Rabbi Yossi that normally you can eat until dark, but Pesach is different because Pesach has a special consideration of matzah. That's answer number one. Answer number two is that the Mishnah follows the view of Rav Yehuda that you always have to stop eating, even on Friday afternoon. But Pesach is different because it begins the prohibition begins a half an hour earlier. In other words, instead of 2.5 hours before dark, it's 3 hours before dark. Okay, so the Gemara gives these two answers. Now, after you finish learning this Gemara, there are a number of things you don't know. Two things you don't know. First of all, you don't know, do we follow the view of Rav Yehuda that every Friday afternoon you have to stop eating 2.5 hours before dark? Or do I follow Rav Yossi that there's no problem? So in other words, I don't know what the law is regarding Friday afternoon, nor do I know what the law is regarding Passover, because if the Passover restriction only follows the opinion that says you can't eat 2.5 hours before dark, and Passover adds an extra half hour, that would mean that if you follow the lenient view of Rav Yossi, there'd be no distinction between Passover and Friday, and you could always continue eating. So the point is that when you learn these passages of Talmud, and you have a diversity of opinion, and you have different interpretations within a given opinion, you have to check the halachic sources for what is the bottom line. Now, I mentioned that the two definitive halachic works, the most definitive, are Maimonides' Code, which is called the Mishneh Torah, the repetition of the law, and more recently is the Shulchan Aruch, which is the set table. Now, it's interesting that Maimonides' Code is called, has two names. It is called the Mishneh Torah, which means the repetition of the Torah, because he basically said, learn the Chumash and learn my code and you'll know everything. You don't have to go back in the Talmudic discussion. And as I mentioned yesterday, he was criticized for that because people feel you have to grasp the Talmud to really understand the law. And the other name of his book was Yad HaChazaka. Yad HaChazaka means the strong hand, the mighty hands. Why was it called the mighty hands? Because Yad is also a hand, and it's also numbers, right? Letters in Hebrew represent numbers. Yud and Dalet represent the number, what? 14. And his code consisted of 14 books. 14 volumes, 14 treatises. Maimonides' Code is the only one that gives you the laws, not only for those things we do today, but even for sacrifices and purities and those things which don't apply today. They're all in Maimonides' Code, which was written in the 1500s by Rav Yosef Karo, omits the materials that are not applicable today. The Shulchan Aruch is limited to laws that apply today, and there are four sections to the Shulchan Aruch. The first section deals with the laws of Shabbos, holidays, prayer, the daily stuff. In fact, if you're familiar with the work Mishneh Berurah, the six volumes of the Mishneh Berurah are just a commentary on the first volume of the Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim. The second volume deals with kashrus laws, the third volume deals with family law, the fourth volume deals with business law and the like. This is the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch was a Sfardi. Shulchan Aruch came originally from Spain. In fact, he was 4 years old during the Spanish expulsion of the Jews in 1492. And therefore, his decisions did not always incorporate the customs that had arisen in Germany, Poland, and Russia. So there was another man, Rav Moshe Isserles, who lived around the same time, who lived in Krakow, Poland, who wrote glosses to the Shulchan Aruch incorporating Ashkenazic variations. And he called his work the tablecloth. If the Shulchan Aruch means the prepared table, all the food is on the table, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, abbreviated the Ramah, Reish Mem Aleph, called his book the Mapa, the tablecloth, on Rav Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch, his set table. And basically, the way it works today is, if you're Ashkenaz, you follow the decisions of Ramah. If you're Svard, you follow the decisions of the Shulchan Aruch. But in any volume of the Shulchan Aruch, they're both printed together. The block letters will be the Shulchan Aruch proper, and the Rashi script letters will be the Ramah, right in the middle there. Now, what I want to show you is this. Let's assume I'm learning a piece of Gemara, and the Gemara records 20 opinions and gives 5 interpretations for each opinion, right? Not an unusual situation. And I want to know how the Shulchan Aruch, where in the Shulchan Aruch will I be given a ruling? Or where in Maimonides' Code will I be given a ruling? Well, we have excellent, excellent cross-references and indexing in a page of Gemara. You'll notice little letters, like a little aleph in the middle of a Talmud page. And the aleph is a footnote that sends you to the outer right-hand margin, in which for every footnote there is a reference to Maimonides and to the Shulchan Aruch, and you can know exactly where to look to see the final halakha. Now, this is not part of the original Talmud, of course, because all these codes came later, but this was added at around the 1600s and 1700s. Now, you can also do it in reverse. Let's assume I'm learning Shulchan Aruch, and I want to know, and Shulchan Aruch says a certain opinion, and I want to know where in the Talmud can this opinion be discussed and elaborated and get the background. In Shulchan Aruch, there are cross-references to Talmudic discussions. So wherever, whichever place you start, you can get into the other. If you start in the Talmud, you can get into Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam. And if you start in Shulchan Aruch and Rambam, you can get back into the Talmud. Okay, so we have a very extensive system of cross-referencing. Now, the big gap until very recently was that the responsa literature, the She'ilot, the Tshuvot, were extremely difficult to access. And now we have computerization, but again, not everybody is familiar with how to use that yet. Even many great rabbis aren't that familiar with it. So it hasn't achieved the widespread use, but at least the tool is going to be there for access. I should say that the responsa has widely varying authority. In other words, you may have 10,000 books, but they're not all of equal rank. And those responsa that are of the first rank were always known by the great rabbis. Some of the lesser ones weren't known, but some rabbis would say, "Who says I have to know them?" There's not necessarily a responsibility to blindly follow every person who puts something in writing. If you'd like to, if you'd write something up and you can get it printed too, it wouldn't necessarily have some immediate authority. Okay, so that's kind of some background information I wanted to share with you. So this week we've discussed so far the structural components of the oral law, and we've discussed some of the literary works in which these structural components are enshrined. I should say, too, that there is, just as there is in other academic disciplines, in law and medicine, there are journals. There are actually journals, magazines, which are devoted to discussion of current issues of Jewish law. Some of them are lay publications, so to speak, that are kind of accessible to everybody, like Tradition Magazine and the like. And others are kind of specialized technical journals that are only for rabbis. Well, anybody can read them, but basically they'd only be understood by rabbis of considerable sophistication. And very often these journals are the places where new responsa are discussed. For example, if when genetic engineering started and there were some questions about how that's done, this would be discussed in a halachic journal. And very often, the way people publish responsa books is they write the stuff in journals over a course of many years, and then they collect their journal articles and publish it in a book. This is exactly what people in the academic world do as well. So we actually have these journals, and once again, they're not indexed very well. And, it's hard for a rabbi who's given a question to know to look in some journal. That's not going to be neat unless he subscribes to it. That's not going to be very easy. But there is a wealth of information in those materials. And especially in Israel. Israel particularly has a proliferation of rabbinical journals and halachic journals covering all sorts of issues. You see that in Eretz Yisrael, halacha has a unique relevance. And that is, in Eretz Yisrael, because religious Jews are also involved in the state and in governance of the state, at least at some level, so even political issues are examined through the prism of Jewish law. So for example, land for peace, which is an issue we're going to be discussed. In America, we're not. George Bush does not ask the Orthodox community how they want to respond to a certain question of policy. In Israel, because of the realities of coalition governments, halacha does have an input into the process. Whether you think that's proper or not is another question, but it certainly is a reality. And therefore, in Eretz Yisrael, halacha is not limited to kind of the ritual matters, but it very much gets involved in political questions, diplomatic affairs, and the like. Okay. Are there any questions or comments on any of this introductory material? Okay. All right. Well, we can begin. We have a long list of various topics we're going to discuss. I don't think we'll be able to cover all of them in the space of a month. But the first topic on the list, we'll start with number one, I believe, is the right to die. Is there a right to die in Jewish law? As you know, in the American system, in the past few years, there has been increasingly come to be recognized that people have a right to death with dignity. There was a case in the United States 2 years ago, or maybe it was just a year ago in the summer, with an unfortunate woman, Nancy Cruzan, don't know if you've heard of this case. Nancy Cruzan was a woman that was in an automobile accident in her 20s, and she was in a coma, and she was hooked up to respirators and artificial hydration and nutrition, that's food and water, through a tube inserted in her stomach. Her parents wanted to have her, not only her life, not only her respiration, but also her food and her water discontinued, because they said that she certainly would not have wanted to live in this type of mechanical state. They had to go to court to petition to, you know, to have the court allow them to discontinue her food and water. The Supreme Court of Missouri says they couldn't do that because they didn't have evidence that that's what she wanted. Just because the parents want it isn't enough. There had to have been evidence that that's what she wanted.
She left some kind of, like a will saying that if something happened.
Well, that's right. She did not leave that. In other words, the only evidence that the parents could produce is some conversation she had with her roommate that if something ever happened to her, she wouldn't want to be in that state. But, you know, somebody just said that as a casual remark. It didn't really mean that that's what she meant. The Supreme Court of the United States, in a 5-4 decision, basically agreed that her feeding could not be disconnected. But what's important is not what the court said, but what the court suggested. The court suggested, however, that the reason she could not be disconnected is because she had never expressed what her wishes really would have been. But, the court said, if she would have expressed in what is called an advance directive, that is the buzzword we use, advance directive is simply some statement like a living will, that's what these are called, that says, in the event I'm incapacitated, I don't want to be kept alive by artificial means, the Supreme Court said she would have had a constitutional right to decline life-saving medical intervention. Okay, which means the Supreme Court recognized for the first time 2 years ago a constitutional right not to commit suicide. She couldn't kill herself by taking a gun and shooting herself, but to recognize that she had a right to decline treatments that would otherwise keep her alive. Now, keep in mind the following. Someone like Nancy Cruzan is not a terminally ill patient. She was not somebody who would die anyway in a short time, like the person that has 10 months to live, and if you give them chemo, they'll live another 1 month. That's a terminal condition. They'll die either way. She could have been kept alive in that condition for many, many years. That's number one. So the Supreme Court basically said, again, I'm not talking Jewish law right now, I'm talking Yeah.
Could she function at all? I mean, could she keep her alive?
Okay, her situation was she was in a what is called an irreversible coma. So basically that means her breathing, you know, she's capable of breathing, but she's unconscious, and she's not responsive to anybody. Well, there's always a chance. There are people who have been in comas for 30 years and have come back. But medical diagnosis feels that there's no chance. That doesn't mean there isn't.
So what's keeping her alive, the coma itself?
Well, a person in a coma, you see, a person in a coma, basically that means there's been a destruction of the cerebrum, the part of the brain that has intellect and consciousness. But the brain stem, the base of the brain, that controls breathing and heartbeats and bodily functions, that still functions. A person in a coma does have a brain stem. It's not brain dead. See, this is a mistake. This is a matter of definition. There is a concept called brain death, but brain death is when a person's total brain has been destroyed. They're incapable of even breathing. They're just a dead body, except they could be hooked up to a respirator. Now that's a separate thing, because I could take a dead body and hook up a dead body and pump up a lung. But people in comas, we call them sometimes vegetables, although that's not the best way of calling them. People in comas are not brain dead. There might be cerebral death or malfunction. But the breathing is autonomous. They're breathing on their own. Okay? So keep in mind that she was not terminal, although she was in what is called a persistent vegetative state. That's PVS. That means irreversible coma. But what her parents wanted to take away was not medical treatment like surgery. They wanted to take away food and water. And the Supreme Court intimated that if she would have said she didn't want to have food and water, she could have starved to death. She would have been, yeah.
According to, we said before, in this case, if they had put her to the, the artificial feeding and everything, and then they found out later that she left the declaration, would they be allowed to disconnect her from it?
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court said there's no difference between not giving it to her and taking it away. So the Supreme Court went pretty far in recognizing that a person basically, even if they're in a non-terminal condition, they're not going to die if they get this treatment. And even if it's food and water, it's not medicine or surgery, just food and water. They have the right to say, I don't want it. In Cruzan, they didn't know what she wanted, so they couldn't say that. But if she would have said, this is what I want, it would have been recognized. And not only that, it would have been recognized as a matter of constitutional law. Now, that's extremely important. Again, I don't want to turn this into a class on American law. I'm kind of wearing my other position here. But the reason it is important is, in American law, when something is a constitutional right, that means the states do not have authority to pass laws against that. Which means a state could not even pass a law taking away that right because it's a constitutional right that the person has. We also know that there's a society called the Hemlock Society, which is designed to encourage people, you know, hemlock after Socrates who drank the hemlock, to encourage people to, when they feel it's time to go, just to commit suicide. There's this guy running around called a doctor, he's called Dr. Death, Dr. Kevorkian, who's a pathologist, who's invented this suicide machine, where it's a car, basically it's an automobile that you hook up and exhaust, and it goes into the car, and it causes death by carbon monoxide. And at patient's request, he's helped patients who have Alzheimer's and the like commit suicide. Now, he doesn't kill them. He just shows them how to do it, and then they do it with his machine, and they die. And, of course, he has their injunctions against him and everything else, but he keeps on doing it. In the state of Washington, this past November, there was a referendum, you know, a vote, to legitimate and permit physician-assisted suicides, that people should be allowed to have a doctor help them kill themselves. And it was defeated, but 45% of the electorate vote was in favor of it. So it wasn't defeated by much. My guess is, and many other people's guess is, that by the end of the 20th century, we will see in the United States, at least in some states, because every state has a different thing, we will see the legitimation of physician-assisted suicides. This is going to be the trend. In the Netherlands, it is already the case that if a patient is in a terminal condition, he's going to die anyway, a doctor can assist that patient committing suicide. So the right to die, death with dignity, and the like, is becoming part of the public rhetoric. And there's getting to be widespread support in the public mind that people should have a right, as it were, not only to die, but to even actively have themselves killed. Now you see, of course, you have to be very sensitive to gradations. In a case like Cruzan, the issue is simply withholding, not giving something that keeps you alive. In Kevorkian, it's already turning into killing people, right? So the active-passive distinctions aren't going to be as clear as they once were. Yeah, did you have a question? Oh. So the issue we want to discuss is, what does Jewish law say about a person's right to die? Does a person have that right? Is there a distinction between actively killing yourself, like taking, you know, a knife and killing yourself, or not taking treatments that will keep you alive? Do we have that distinction and the like? Okay, well, first, we ought to preface it with some basic points. How does Judaism regard medical technology generally? You know that there are religious groups, Christian scientists and the like, that say, if God makes you sick, only God is supposed to cure you, and for you to go to a doctor, for you to take medicine, for you to have surgery, is interfering with God's plan. Right? There is that theological position. What do we say about that? Well, suffice it to say that we more or less reject that. And I'll give you some sources. In the book of Exodus, in Parshat Mishpatim, the Torah talks about a person who injures another person. And it says, if I injure you, I have to pay your lost wages. For rapo yirapo, and I have to pay your medical expenses. So the Talmud remarks in Bava Kamma, if I have to pay your medical expenses, that means you're allowed to incur medical expenses. Mikan, from here we can see that a doctor has permission to practice medicine. You need a pasuk, you couldn't just say it on your own. But the Torah legitimates the doctor's practice of medicine. Rashi raises the question, why do I need the Torah to permit a doctor to practice medicine? And Rashi answers, I might have thought, like a Christian scientist, he doesn't use those words, but that's it. I might have thought that since God makes you sick, only God can cure you. The Torah says no.
we regard the physician as the emissary and the shaliach and the agent of God. Therefore, rather than interfering with God's plan, medical technology, medical therapy is a furtherance of God's plan. Nachmanides, by the way, gives another explanation. Nachmanides says that I don't need a pasuk that a doctor could practice. That's obvious. I need a pasuk that a doctor could charge. Why? And the reason I need a pasuk that a doctor could charge is technically people who are doing mitzvot, people who are involved in fulfilling commandments, are not supposed to get money for their services. Technically, rabbis are not supposed to be being rabbis. We've worked out a way over the years. But technically, we're not supposed to get paid. For example, a teacher of Torah is not supposed to get paid for teaching the Torah. One reason he gets paid is for babysitting, right? I'm keeping you guys off the street. That's mainly for smaller kids. But anyway, or I get paid for the opportunities that I forego working as a diamond merchant or the like. I'm not getting paid for what I'm doing. I'm getting paid for what I'm not doing as a result of doing this, right? But be it as it may, you're not supposed to get paid for mitzvot, whether you're a rabbi, you're a cantor, or a teacher, or the like. So the doctor's also doing a mitzvah, as we'll see, restoring life and health. So I would have thought he couldn't charge. Nachmanides says, no, the Torah permits the doctor to charge a reasonable fee. So says Nachmanides, who himself was a doctor, and he does suggest that if you don't charge a reasonable fee, indeed you are stealing. It's inappropriate to charge for your mitzvah beyond a living wage. Okay, so again, so source number one is in Mishpatim, in Exodus, that the doctor has permission to practice healing, that we reject the idea of an interference. This is an important notion, because if you look at Catholic medical ethics, in the papal pronouncements on a variety of subjects, there's a constant refrain between certain things are okay because they're natural, and certain things are not okay because they're unnatural. To give you one example, if you take in vitro fertilization, right? In vitro fertilization is where a female egg is impregnated not in the body of the woman, but in a dish, and then it's implanted. So in Judaism, as we'll discuss, essentially it's all right. There are some problems, but that's, you know, perfectly valid way of having a child. But the papal pronouncement originally, I'm not sure if he still stands by this, was, well, this isn't proper because this is not the natural way of having children. There's a distinction, in other words, between the normal way and the unnatural way. But you see, that type of ethic posits a dichotomy or a contradiction between nature, that's a product of God, and technology and human creativity, which is somehow an interference or something that we're superimposing on God's perfect world. But in Judaism, we reject that type of dichotomy, because in Judaism we believe that human creativity and human discovery and technological advance are gifts that God gave us. If we are able to discover a polio vaccine, that came from God. You're not interfering with God. So although there'll be many problems in the medical ethical area, but the one thing you will not find in Jewish discussions is condemning something just because it's not natural. That is not a rhetoric that we use, because that's a dichotomy that is foreign to the Jewish subject. Now, why did God want there to be a polio vaccine in 1954? And in the 40s and 30s, children were dying of polio or were crippled? I don't know. And I don't know why God wants certain things to be revealed at certain times. But it's clear that if wisdom and insight are there, Hashem wants us to use them for the benefit of mankind. All right, and that is the underlying basis of the permission that the doctor is given to practice the healing arts. Now, keep in mind that the Torah does not take sides as to what is considered valuable medical therapy. I mean, obviously, I don't mean to suggest that the only legitimate treatment under Torah law is the high technology end of it. You know, that's a matter of scientific decision, and you know, the patient has to make a decision there. But I do mean that there's nothing per se wrong in utilizing whatever is out there to alleviate illness. Now, second point. Not only is it permissible to utilize medical therapy, but it's considered to be a mitzvah, it is a commandment, both on the part of the healthcare provider, doctor, nurse, physician, and on the part of the healthcare provider, we have a verse in Leviticus that says, "Lo ta'amot al dam reyecha." This is a very, very famous and important verse that says, "Don't stand by idly over your friend's blood." Let me explain what that is. You know, I teach law school back in the States too, and one of the things that we like to teach first-year law students is that law has nothing to do with morality. Secular law has nothing to do with morality. And the example that everybody likes to give is this. Imagine that you're Mark Spitz, who just won your eight gold medals, I don't know, seven gold medals, swimming. You're walking by, and you see a four-year-old child who just fell into a pool. And the four-year-old child is drowning, and nobody else is around. And the child says, "Help me, help me." And you, Mark Spitz, who just won your seven gold medals for swimming, says, "Sorry, I'm late for my date." And the child drowns. Or what if you didn't even have to get yourself wet? What if there's simply a life preserver or tube you could just throw to the person? And the person and you don't do it. As a result, the person dies. What do you think? So first-year law students who still have morality and conscience will scream, "Awful, awful, this person should go to jail for life." And we say, "Sorry, under the common law of the United States and England, there is no affirmative duty to help. You can't hurt somebody. I can't push somebody in the water. But there is no obligation on my part to render assistance to somebody in need. Omission, in other words, omission, pure omission, does not create legal liability in a secular sense. Moreover," and this is the paradox of the Good Samaritan, "moreover, if you're a doctor, for example, or if you try to help the person and you mess up, you can be in a lot more trouble than if you never did it at all. The doctor who stops and tries to help the victim of the accident and does something wrong is in a lot more trouble than the doctor who doesn't stop at all." And this is because the common law system, the American legal system, is based on the idea that every man, every person is an island. That essentially we're not responsible for each other. We live in our own space. And my only job is not to cut into your space. I cannot invade your space. As long as I don't invade your space, what happens to you is none of my business. And that's the underlying predicate of what is called the very individualistic system of law. Well, Judaism repudiates that notion elegantly in a single pasuk. "Lo ta'amod al dam reyacha" says, it's not enough not to hurt people. You cannot stand by when somebody else is being harmed. The Gemara says if somebody is drowning, you have to try to save them. This refers to economic assistance, physical assistance, emotional support, religious, whatever you could provide. Whatever you are able to do for another person, you are supposed to do. Judaism, in other words, rejects the idea of each person being an individual. It rejects the idea of each person living their own life with the minimal restriction of not cutting into somebody else. And Judaism embodies a notion of collective concern for each other's welfare. Okay? So obviously, if somebody is sick and I'm a doctor, now again, I have a mitzvah to help that person out because I can't stand by idly while that person is suffering. Now keep in mind, "Lo tamod al dam reyecha" is not limited to doctors. It's a mitzvah that applies to all of us. However, the particular form that the mitzvah will take is a function of a person's skill. In other words, my mitzvah is not to do brain surgery on you. I mean, because I don't know how to do it. In fact, it would probably be a mitzvah for me not to even try. Each person, in other words, carries out this mitzvah based on their talents, their abilities, their opportunities. It's an interesting question that's raised. Well, what does that mean? "Lo tamar al dam reyecha." What if the patient can't afford to pay me? Am I obligated because of this mitzvah to help this patient out even if he can't pay me? Or I could be a lawyer or doctor, whatever it is. Am I obligated to do so? Well, again, the commentaries have said if there's no other doctor
who will be well again, you're back in this circle, that if you have a system, again, in Israel it's less pressing because you have Kupat Chalim, you have socialized medicine. But in the States, the concept is this. If there are clinics which are funded by the government that take indigent people, then you have no obligation to see the patient because there will be other opportunities to take care of them. If there are no indigent clinics around, then the doctor has to take the patient for free. That's 100% correct.
Is it American law or
halacha? No, halacha. American law, he doesn't. No, halacha. He must take the patient for free. Same thing for a lawyer. Lo tamad ol dam reyecha. Okay. So that's one notion. Now that's the negative commandment. Do not stand by idly when somebody is suffering. There's also a positive commandment. There's a mitzvah in the Torah called Hashavat Aveda. What is Hashavat Aveda? Returning a lost object. If I see your cow wandering around, I'm supposed to hold it until your return. If I see a pen, I'm supposed to put up a sign and say, I have a pen, come claim it. Now in America you don't have to do that, because in America the halakha is that this mitzvah only applies vis-a-vis other Jews, and where you can assume it was lost by a non-Jew, there's not necessarily such a mitzvah. But be it as it may, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following bit of reasoning. If I have to return your cow, how much more so is there a mitzvah for me to restore your health? Losing one's health is much more serious than losing health. So if there's a mitzvah to restore a lost monetary object, how much more so is there a mitzvah to restore lost health? And that is the positive side of the ledger. So the doctor has both a negative prohibition, not standing by his friend's blood, and a positive admonition of Hashavat Aveda to render medical assistance. Yes? That's correct.
Where's the analogy with your own health?
No. That's the next point I'm going to make. In other words, so far I'm discussing the doctor's obligation towards the patient. Yeah, right. Now, the next part of it is what I'm going to say right now. Now, the next part of it is, what about the patient's own obligations to seek medical assistance? Can a patient just say, I'd rather die, I don't really care? Here we have the verse in the book of Deuteronomy that says, "V'nishmartem ol v'nafshoseichem," you should preserve your souls, but we interpret that, one of the interpretations is, there's a mitzvah in a person to preserve their health and preserve their body. You see, we don't believe that the body is the purpose of life. We don't believe that the purpose of life is to have physical pleasures and everything else. We believe the purpose of life is for the soul to serve Hashem, serve God, by doing God's commandments. Okay? However, it's also indisputably true that the only medium in which we can serve God by doing His commandments is in the bodies that we have. Once we die, our souls go to Olam Haba, the world to come, we get reward, but we lose the ability to do mitzvot. It says in the book of Psalms, Lo ha-nesim yahaleluka, those who are dead are no longer capable of praising God by doing His mitzvot. And thus, although the body is not something that we intrinsically value, we don't intrinsically value it, but we regard it as basically a temple for the soul, and therefore it must be taken care of and nurtured. That is why you will see it is generally forbidden for Jewish people to do things that endanger life. Obviously the question that will occur to all of you is, are religious Jews allowed to smoke? A very, very serious question. There are many opinions that say religious Jews are not allowed to smoke. Other opinions haven't gone that far yet, but there certainly is a notion that if you haven't started smoking, you're not supposed to start. Yeah?
Can the same thing apply to harmful food that shouldn't get a hechsher or something?
Well, it's an argument, but again, you have to define what harmful is. Now, we'll be discussing this because if you take saccharin and diet soda, harmful. If you have a 1 in a million chance or something, you have to drink 16 cans of diet soda for 20 years to create a risk. Now, I know people that probably drink that amount, so it's not beyond the realm of possibility. But generally speaking, let's put it this way. Every time you get into a car, you're engaging in a dangerous activity. So we have to define with some specificity what is the level of danger. When does something become so dangerous that you're not allowed to do it? Yeah.
So what about God?
What about
God?
Okay, well, I think it's a perfect example. I don't think that Jewish law would permit
engaging in very hazardous activities just for the sake of amusement and recreation. It's one thing if you're a chayav, if you're a soldier and you have to practice parachuting to be able to perform your job, that's one thing. But just for sport, now I know that many people get a tremendous rush and a tremendous sense of excitement doing dangerous things. And I can appreciate that, but we would say that that's because perhaps they haven't really found real meaning in their lives, that people have to look for diversions. So halacha would be look very askance at getting involved in dangerous things just for kicks. Yeah. Be a professional skydiver? Well, if you have a choice, people don't always have choices. If you have a choice, you should pick something that's less hazardous.
It's incorrect to pick something that might be hazardous.
I think so. If you have the choice. If you have the choice, yes.
I think Rabbi Goldie was talking about if you have like a talent and that's your best talent for them, you should employ that.
Hmm. But he didn't say it in this context, did he?
No.
No, okay, yeah. Well, you know, you're raising a very good question. On one hand, the point is absolutely correct that Hashem gives us special talents and He wants us to use our talents where they're best deployed. So you're raising the question, what if a person's best talent is in some dangerous line of work? I would still say in that case that there has to be some type of sublimation. I mean, there has to be some way that talent could be utilized. I mean, it's not like people only have talents for skydiving. I mean, they could be utilized in something else, something safer. Maybe airline pilots, which is relatively much safer than skydiving. Now they have a new thing. See, people have an endless... It's really an addiction. Because when you're addicted to thrills, just like with drugs, you have to have a higher and higher dose. You have to have a higher and higher thrill level, scare level. There's something new now. I just saw in a magazine. But after bungee is already... There's this like sky... sky skiing, I'm not sure what it is exactly. You kind of water ski, but you water ski on a cloud. And you try to go along on a horizontal line before you open your parachute. You just, because somehow the propulsion just keeps you going. All right, whatever. Okay, yeah.
Wouldn't shaving serve life threatening?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Shaving? Is there a life threatening? What's wrong with like a regular razor? Like a big razor?
Okay, I'm not sure where you got that. In other words, it is true the Torah prohibits the use of a razor. But the reason that was not because it was life-threatening. Actually, we don't know the exact reason. Some say because it was customary for the idolatrous nations to kind of shave their beards and their heads with razors. And God doesn't want us to emulate idolatrous customs. So it wasn't an issue of life-threatening in that case. It was simply an issue of not following the heathen practices of idolatry. Okay. All right. So what we've established so far, just from biblical sources, is we've established, number one, the permissibility of medical intervention and even its inherent desirability as preserving life. Indeed, by the way, this mitzvah of preserving your health and life is an argument that argues in favor of regular exercise and the like. Again, some of us are not as conscientious as we should be, but that's a failing. It's not something to be proud about. And people should indeed take care of themselves to get sleep and to eat correctly and etc. Because that is the way one serves Hashem. And sometimes even the greatest righteous people need to be reminded of this. And it says the Chafetz Chaim used to go to the Beis HaMedrash late at night and shut off the lights. He would send people to bed. He says you have to have regular sleep. Because what's going to happen is, if your health is ruined, then ultimately you won't be able to do any of the mitzvot later on. Yeah.
If there is a situation that would require an overt miracle in order to restore health, i.e. somebody is suffering of cancer, and they've already had chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy has destroyed their immune system, so their body is being racked by internal infections, and they're already on a breather, and they're unconscious, and their brain is shut down, and their liver is shut down.
Yeah,
except my father, Mamish, and it would have required an overt miracle for him to get off of that bed ever, not even to be in a coma, just for him ever to not to for him to live more than 2 days would have required an overt miracle. And I wasn't from at the time, and my brother was, and he said, it's our obligation to keep him alive for those 2 days. Yet, despite the fact that it was destroying my mother, it was doing him absolutely no good.
Yeah.
Are we obligated in that situation to maintain life?
Okay, that's really the core of what we're going to talk about. Most authorities would say no.
No?
Yes, would say no. It's interesting that earlier, what you will find in Jewish literature, Jewish medical ethics, is that you must. But most authorities would say no in that case. I'll explain why later. I would not. Again, it depends on the nature of the treatment. You have to give food and water. You can never starve a person. But in terms of continuing to pump in with chemo or antibiotics, many would say there's no obligation to keep on going. Okay, but again, I'm going to elaborate on that in great detail as we go on. What time do you have?
1 o'clock.
Okay. All right. So that's point number one, really. Point number one in this area is the permissibility and desirability of medical intervention. The truth of the matter is the following. There's a story that illustrates how we view the physician. A story about a man called Revizel Acharif, Revizel the Sharp One, and you'll see why he was given this nickname. He was known, great rabbi in 19th century Lithuania, who was known for his acuity of mind. The story was that once he was deathly ill, he was very, very ill, the doctor gave up and said he's going to die overnight, that's nothing I can do for him, and miraculously this Revizel was cured. So a few weeks later, he's walking in the street, he bumps into the doctor. The doctor turns white as a sheet, as if he had seen a ghost, and blurts out, I thought you were dead. And Revizel says, yeah, I was dead, but I did you a great favor when I came back, and I'll tell you the favor I did. I went up to heaven, and I saw a long line of people, including you, in the line on the way to a gate. And I asked the angel, what's this the gate to? And the angel said, well, this is the gate to hell, because there's a statement in the Talmud that says even the best doctors go to hell. I'll explain what that means. If any of you are from doctors' families. And I said, let that man go. He's no doctor. The concept that the best of the doctors go to hell, what does that mean? It seems like a very pejorative concept. And there are a lot of reasons. One reason that's given, interesting enough, very modern reason that's given, is the best doctor, the one who's the greatest expert, is sometimes too arrogant to consult with colleagues. And it's very important, especially in medicine, to consult with other doctors. Now, if you're a big shot, it's harder for you. If you're a little guy, so you'll consult. If you're a big shot, it's much more difficult. And sometimes the arrogance of the best doctor will result in not consulting, which will hurt the patient. The patient dies, and God holds that doctor responsible for not doing what he could have done. That's one. It's a very modern explanation of the best of the doctors. But there's a little Hasidic interpretation of the best of the doctors. The word is tov. As we know, gematria, gematria is every letter has a numerical equivalent as well. What is the numerical equivalent of tov? We have tet, which is 9, 17, right. So tov shib, very good. Tov shib berofim is a doctor who, when he prays to God, only concentrates on 17 of the 18 blessings in the Shemona Esrei. We know that the Shemona Esrei has 18 blessings. Actually, it has 19 later, but the original is 18. One of those blessings is we acknowledge God as the source of healing. So the tov, the doctor that concentrates on 17, but he doesn't recognize that God is the source of healing, that doctor is despicable. But if a doctor has the recognition that he's a shaliach of God, then God blesses him. And the truth of the matter is, although you will find many doctors who are heretics and non-believers, but some of the greatest physicians talk about almost the palpable sense they have of God giving them the ability to do what they're doing. There's a black neurosurgeon in Baltimore, Ben Carson, very, very talented person, actually a very, very inspiring story. He's not Jewish, but I mean, he came up from a ghetto background in Detroit. He basically joined a gang, and somehow he got steered into, now he's the chairman of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And he writes how before every operation, he prays, it's not our God, but you know, the idea of God is certainly in his heart. He prays to God to give him the ability, and he really feels the divine force in his hands as he operates. And
this is something that we Jewish people should feel and also take in, because that's exactly the attitudes that we should have as well. And the concept is that the doctor that is a shaliach of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is blessed as an emissary of heaven. The doctor who's not that shaliach becomes arrogant and will be held responsible for what he eventually does wrong. Okay, so, yes. Well, there are different levels of hell, you know. Dante had 7 levels of purgatory. Okay, we go to the lower levels. Okay, but again, keep in mind that, you know, in spite of that comment, we find that the greatest Jewish rabbis, medicine was the profession that they did gravitate to. I could just mention the Rambam, Maimonides, mention Nachmanides, so suffice it to say that medicine was considered to be really the most honorable profession for good Jewish boys to go into, as it still is today. Okay, let me just finish one more thought. Okay, maybe we'll stop here and we'll continue. Let's see.